This is Going Public. I'm Dan Woods. There has been a lot of talk in recent weeks about the filibuster in the United States Senate. Republicans want to keep it, and most Democrats want to do away with it. A filibuster is used to prevent a measure from being brought to a vote. To break a filibuster, it takes 60 votes, which is tough in a 50-50 Senate. If the filibuster remains in place, which looks likely at least for now, will legislation just sit in the Senate in the near term, or will it foster more compromise? I spoke with Jason Sides. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Southeast Missouri State, and I started by asking him when the filibuster first started being used in the Senate.
So the filibuster can be traced back to a rule change in the early days of the Senate. There was a rule change which provided for this particular option to be used by senators. It wasn't something that found a lot of use in the 19th century, though. It's going to be something that gains in usage, gains in popularity later in the 19th century. So it has its roots in a relatively innocuous rule change that people really didn't utilize or recognize for what it has become today back then. They just passed the rule and it sat on the books. Well, when some of the more contentious issues originated in the, you know, in the 20th and the 19th centuries, you started to see more utilization of this technique as a way to slow down legislation and to make sure that the minority party had a voice in what was being brought to the floor.
I saw a graph that the use of the filibuster has increased as we've gotten closer to now 2021. And in many cases, not always used, but just threatened to be used.
Yeah, there was a rule change that allowed senators to, in effect, put the body on notice that they were going to filibuster. And that notice allowed them to act as though it had actually occurred. So a lot of people think of a filibuster and they think of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And they think of Jimmy Stewart standing up there holding letters, I think it was from Cub Scouts or Boy Scouts or something, to the point of exhaustion. And then they have to carry him off the floor in a dramatic scene, one of the best in Hollywood. That is not really how the filibuster operates today. Today, you as a senator can put the rest of the body on notice that you are going to filibuster a piece of legislation. And through a rule change made a number of years ago, that particular piece of legislation is then set aside so that they can go on to work on other important tasks. Now, the effect is that the offending piece of legislation is stopped dead in its tracks, but it also allows the body to move forward with other things simultaneously. So it still has the same consequence as that more dramatic type of effort that we'd see in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But it also has the benefit of allowing things to move forward.
And to break a filibuster, you have to have 60 votes, right? And right now in a 50-50 Senate, there's talk about getting rid of the filibuster. Many folks have said its time has passed. Well, otherwise, we'll never get anything substantive done because people can just say filibuster.
Yeah, so you could theoretically see a very rarely used technique where two-thirds of the body would reclaim time from the person who's engaging in a filibuster. And so that would require more than the 60 votes. But that has traditionally been seen as kind of almost as a way of besmirching the senator who's conducting the filibuster. So that technique's rarely used. But yeah, this other rules change still allows 60 senators to say, okay, we've gotten to 61. The filibuster's moot. We need to move forward. But again, getting back to your point, in such a partisan era where we have a 50-50 Senate, it's unlikely that you're going to get 10 Republicans to defect to filibuster something that's put forward by a Democrat, and conversely getting 10 Democrats to break with their party to, you know, break a filibuster that a Democrat's putting forward.
If the filibuster stays in place, could this help to foster more cooperation and more bipartisanship on legislation?
Ideally, it would, yeah. given the hyper-partisan era that we're in, it might work to slow things down, but ideally it would. I mean, both parties are kind of playing to their voters. And what we've seen among the electorate is that both the Republicans and the Democrats are moving away from one another. That middle voter, that voter who is living in middle America, Peoria, is no longer the model that we're talking about when we discuss the average voter. There is no more average voter. You have average Republicans who are more conservative, average Democrats who are more liberal, but that middle that can kind of be looked to moderate things doesn't really exist anymore. And so here's the thing. Without that moderate middle voter there demanding change, I don't know that there's going to be a lot of compromise, because both the Republicans and the Democrats want their team to do what they think is right in the Senate.
So could we have another, could we have a situation where the House will pass legislation, it will go to the Senate, and just nothing will happen?
Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of that. Yeah, I think that's what we're in for. The, if you look at the, if you look at the Democrats in the House, there's more cohesiveness among the Democrats. And so they'll put forward legislation. That legislation is not going to pass muster with the Republicans in the Senate, because their voters are moving more to the right, and they're going to demand that their Republicans in the Senate uphold whatever values the Republicans are advancing. As a result, the Republicans aren't going to have a lot of motivation to move to the middle, filibuster or otherwise.
Okay, so what other options, if you're Chuck Schumer, you're the majority leader of the Senate, and the filibuster stays in place, I've read something about reconciliation on, I guess, budget bills, but that only works where you can just do a simple majority, but that's not going to work for everything. Are his hands tied in many cases if the filibuster stays in place? What are his options here?
Well, the reconciliation route is dangerous, because you start to establish a precedent that anyone can turn to reconciliation if they have the slimmest margin of power in the Senate, right? So if the Republicans come back and they have a 51-49 advantage, then they could go towards the reconciliation route. And I think in the long run, that really doesn't do favors for our democracy.
Is that only for budget bills, or is that for anything?
There are ways of incorporating things that are not technically budget appropriations into that. And you could include particular policy goals under the guise of furthering an interest with the budget process. So, I mean, you can link things up to it that aren't clearly and, you know, above discussion in terms of being budget measures. You can kind of be creative in how you link that back to the process to include them. But the bigger point is that that particular technique is going to be so problematic in the long haul that if you turn that to standard operating procedure, it really takes some of the safeguards away that have been in place in the Senate. So I think if Schumer were a little bit more interested with history, right? If he were thinking about the long term, thinking about the evolution of the Senate, I think it would be in his interest to give the Republicans a couple of W's on some things to get some buy-in from them. Now, here's the problem. In the past, what might he have given the Republicans? Probably some free trade bills, some tax reform, something along those lines. Well, now, the problem is that the Republicans are no longer as united around those issues. So, you know, Schumer's going to have to work a little bit harder to identify something he can give McConnell a W on that won't completely anger his base, but also that McConnell can get the Republicans on board with in terms of saying, okay, you know, this is a victory. We fought Schumer. We accomplished this. In the past, it would have been a free trade bill or something like that, or maybe some kind of defense authorization. Well, the Republican voters aren't there. Free trade is not the foremost among their policy goals. The appetite for adventurism in foreign affairs has evaporated. some of the cultural issues are no longer there because Trump has appointed so many people to the courts. I mean, what would be the issue that McConnell could turn to voters and say, we fought for you, we've done so well, here's this accomplishment?
And if there's no W's in sight.
Well, there's like some small W's maybe that McConnell could point to, but nothing that's going to turn people out to the polls on a cold, dreary November 2022, Election Day.
Okay, what about this is, I don't know how this would work. Joe Biden was in the Senate for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
He and McConnell seemed to be least cordial to each other. I don't know how deep their relationship is. Is there any chance that if things get really, that Joe Biden really wants something through the Senate, that he calls McConnell? Is there, I think there's any maneuvering room in there because of their relationship?
They do have a deep relationship. And I think we talked about that on election night. The problem is, I think McConnell is losing some power among the Republican members of the Senate. I don't think he has quite the influence that he did in the past. Now, one of the reasons I say this is because, one, he said he was going to win both those seats in Georgia, and he had built a ground game. He developed the policy platform to win. He said he was going to win. He didn't. So I think some of the members are starting to question whether he has his thumb on the pulse of the American voters, or specifically Republican voters.
Okay.
And I think that Georgia debacle kind of highlights that he might not be as in touch as he thinks he is. So that's going to create a little bit of separation. So he's only one man, one. But two, I don't think there's as many Republicans who are willing to buy into McConnellism or whatever platform he's pushing. And so as a result, I don't think he's going to be able to swing enough of them over. That's kind of the problem he has. Here's the other problem. His wife is going to be somebody who jumped out of the Trump administration a little bit early. So there are going to be some voters who are going to hold that against them. You're starting to see some of the right-wing media figures kind of bring up that and ties to possible, you know, insider trading. These were things that some of those conservative media people kept quiet. But now that McConnell has stepped out of line and started criticizing Trump, they're saying, well, hey, we ought to look into this. And so I think McConnell's probably not as strong as he was prior to the election.
He's diminished because of it. Nancy Pelosi was somewhat diminished, too, because she lost House seats in the House of Representatives. I mean, she won re-election to Speaker, but she took some hits because of losing seats, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, she should have won some of those seats in California.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we went home on election night before a lot of those results were in, but we could start to see some really, you know, unexpected results out in California, and sure enough, they came true. So for her to lose seats in places like Orange County or some of the other places in the coast, that did diminish her. Because she said we were going to pick these up. She was even predicting they were going to pick up some seats in Missouri, right? That the Democrat who was running against, Wagner, I believe it was, in St. Louis, right. She was predicting that, you know, Wagner was going to lose and a Democrat was going to pick up the suburbs past St. Louis. That didn't happen. But on top of that, you also lost seats in California, which has been blue for a while now. Yeah, that diminished her strength as well.
A lot of the things that politicians were – patterns that were always there forever, everything has shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they're still adapting to the new landscape. Is that fair to say in some ways?
Yeah, I think – well, they are trying to adapt. But I think we have a bigger situation here. We've been in this post-World War II era for a number of years, right? And there was a general consensus about – what government should do, what government shouldn't do. There was a consensus about what the parties were going to stand on and what they were going to stand for, and they could argue about the details. Well, now as we're getting further and further away, you're starting to see that Cold War era system deteriorate or fall apart. And as that deteriorates, I think some of our more experienced politicians, because I don't want to be ageist here, but some of our more experienced politicians are having more difficulty trying to acclimate themselves to this. And I think that's what you're starting to see among Pelosi and McConnell. McConnell's throwing the greatest hits out there for, you know, 1998 or 2004, when President Clinton or Bush would have been in office. But that's a long time ago, right?
Right.
Pelosi's still throwing some of the greatest hits out there, you know, for a post-Gingrich or post-Hastert speakership. But some of those things aren't as relevant now as they were back then. So, you know, I think these folks are just having a hard time trying to figure out where the footing is for America. Now, what's interesting is you do have a lot of younger politicians in both chambers, right? And some of those folks seem to have a little bit better sense of where things are going. So, like, you know, we have Senator Cotton from Arkansas. He's a younger member. He seems to have a pretty good idea of where the populists in the Republican Party are going, right? Hawley had that kind of populist economic streak as well. Among some of the folks in the House, like AOC, you can see her kind of talking about economic issues in a way that appeals to a lot of voters, right? You could also see, oh gosh, Nancy Mace from South Carolina. You know, she beat a Democrat as a Republican. She's kind of advancing some of these issues that appeal to younger folks and reflect what's going on in America now. So my point is that I think some of those younger folks have a better sense of what's going on, but they're locked out of the leadership positions because of how the seniority system works. And we as the public are suffering for it as a result.
Well, Jason, it's always good to talk with you. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jason Sides is an associate professor of political science at Southeast Missouri State University. To hear more interviews, visit krcu.org.